Hello, this is Father Ray Petrucci. Welcome to Thoughts for the Week. We are going to have a very, very special guest, no stranger to Thoughts for the Week, but always a very special and welcome guest. And we'll get to introducing him. But first, I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to please consider contacting us and letting us know what topics you might want to hear on Thoughts for the Week or any suggestions you may make or comments. You can reach us in two different ways. The first one is by good old-fashioned mail. And if you want to put a stamp on a letter and write us, so we're delighted to hear from you, please write Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466. That's Post Office Box 7466. Greenwich, Connecticut. That's Greenwich, Connecticut. The zip code 06836. Again, 06836. If you're on the computer and prefer to email us, you can do so at the following address, clemons10@aol.com. That's C-L-E-M-O-N-S, the number 10, at aol.com. While you're on the computer still, I invite you to go to our internet magazine, Spirituality for Today, where you will not only find various articles and features, you will find our program available for you and archived, so you can have the opportunity to listen to some past programs too. Now, you will go to find us at spirituality.org. That's spirituality.org. And we certainly hope that you will visit us at that website. Well, the time has come to first visit, or rather introduce, my co-host, Mrs. Dorothy Riera. Dorothy, welcome.
Thank you, Father. Always a pleasure to be here with you and our special guest today.
Yes, we're delighted to go to Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut, and to remove from that august institution one of their august professors. Actually, we're delighted to welcome the Reverend Richard Riscavige, who is a good Jesuit father from Fairfield University, and he is the director of the Center for Faith and Public Life. Father Riscavige, again, no stranger, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
And delighted to have you with us. Thank you for being here. Well, now, this center has a lot more than what the title seems to. Well, the title is very, very far-ranging. So yeah, maybe you could help us first by simply letting us know what the mission of the center is.
Well, it's looking, it was, I was really brought to Fairfield as part of an effort to start a new center, and a center that looked at issues where religion and faith intersects with socioeconomic and political issues. You know, it's a very full of minefields, as you can imagine. I mean, there's a lot of controversial stuff in it, in that area, but it intrigued me, and I really wanted to do it. And we've been working on it now for a number of years, and we have a research program, a very vigorous research program in different areas, including migration, which we'll talk about today, but also we run a undergraduate student program in humanitarian affairs, where we look at humanitarian crises and how the undergraduates could best respond to these things through many different courses. We're beginning to offer a minor starting next year at Fairfield in humanitarian studies, so people who are interested in maybe perhaps even getting into a career in helping in humanitarian problems around the world could start at the undergraduate level and prepare for that kind of a career. So we're all looking forward to that, and we have many faculty involved in this, and it's pretty exciting. And then we also do programs like Fairfield on Wall Street, where we look at young graduates who are working in the financial services and some of the ethical problems and issues that they face as they work away. And we have, of course, our immigrant programs for the undocumented students, as well as for normal immigrant students and faculty and others that come to Fairfield. And we try to help figure out the best way to make them integrate well into the university and into life in the United States.
Aside from the academics at the center, Father, do the students get to go out and do practice?
Yeah, that's, in fact, that's an essential part of our thing. We have a huge program in service learning, and we also try to integrate it into the humanitarian study. So if they're studying humanitarian crisis, we actually try to figure out a crisis where we can go and take a look with students and figure out, see it firsthand, and how people are responding or not responding. And that's been very, students really love that. I mean, it really gets them involved directly. Mm-hmm. We have to be careful, of course. We can't take them to some of the most serious, violent places mm-hmm. that problems are happening right now in the world. But we can find enough particularly natural disasters and things after that occur, even in our own country, you know, post Sandy and all that. And we were very active, and we've been involved with a lot of the tornado issues in the Midwest, where we go to a town that's been completely decimated by a tornado and try to help see what's the best way of responding to these kind of crises. So, yeah, it's, I think getting into a natural situation is a really important part of our learning experience for the undergraduates. Yeah.
You know, I, when you mentioned that new program that you hope to have as actually a major discipline for those studying or interested in the humanitarian, or actually directly in regard to crisis intervention or...
Yes, exactly. And we'll be one of the few universities in the United States that offer that at an undergraduate level. You can study at a graduate level at several universities, but this is one of the first for the undergraduates to actually prepare for it. It's very attractive, I think, to nursing students and other who are looking at careers where they combine a certain expertise in some area, but also want to help in a really humanitarian sort of...
And a lot of companies also have a section in their corporate echelon where humanitarian efforts are very, very important.
Absolutely.
And they donate, and people work in that specific area of the corporation.
That's absolutely right. We're learning that they have so many investments in these countries around the world. They're very conscious of trying to protect the people in the situation where they have put a lot of money, and so they welcome actually people who have a little expertise in this area that they can actually employ and use. And I think it's opening up a whole career range for students too. I know a lot of them have gone into Catholic Relief Services and other sort of nonprofit agencies that are working directly with people in crisis in different parts of the world, and they really enjoy the work, and I think it's a good thing. And I try to encourage people in business and engineering, and because the skills are needed in all these areas when something happens. I was down in Haiti last year, and I mean the engineering needs of that country right now because of bridges and roads and houses, they're just not there anymore, and the need for people with skills in that area are enormous. So the nonprofit companies and companies are looking for people like that. So it's actually a very good career choice for some engineers to actually start specializing in humanitarian problems.
I'm just wondering, especially as you talk about countries like Haiti, or I'm sure many other locations in the world, their situation certainly is not new. And I'm just wondering if there's anything from the point of view of Native education, of bringing them, does anyone from Haiti, certainly priests come here to the United States?
Yes, absolutely.
I wonder if there are Haitian individuals who do come to the United States to learn the skills they need to bring back to the country, or is it still highly dependent on agencies from outside?
Well, it is dependent on the outside in a large part, but there are, yes, Haitians have come and have come back, to try to help their native country, and particularly in these terrible crises. But the problem is the country has so little infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Even with the best skills, sometimes you come back and you say, oh, my goodness, there's no, if you're a doctor and there's no hospitals and there's no medicine and there's no, basic pharmaceuticals, it's very difficult to practice normal medicine in the country. And things like this, really discourage, I think, Haitians who have done very well in the United States in many cases. There's a very prosperous community in Florida and other places of Haitians who have really did their best in the United States and they do want to help, and they do help in terms of sending back money and things like that. But often when they go back, you know, they find it hard to kind of dig in and figure out what can I do here that's actually going to.
And then you deal with the corruption of the government.
Oh, and bad governance is a big issue. I mean, it really affects everything because you can't really trust where the money is going, and you never know if they're going to change their mind about something, and for whatever political reasons, and then you can't carry out a project. You know, it's a very bad situation, actually, for a country like that to be in, because it's really not. You can only hope they'll develop a better political structure in the coming years that'll kind of get the country out of the poverty that it's in. You know. So it's a beautiful country, but very sad in many ways because of all the things that has happened, of natural disasters as well as political disasters and other things. So they've gone through a lot as a country.
I know that we, as we're speaking, we're kind of focusing on Haiti, but I'm almost using it as symbolic of immigration, people who are trying to somehow better the situation.
Absolutely.
Is it another situation in Haiti, and we're again talking about general terms of immigration too, where they are going to Dominican Republic for work?
They are, but they're, you know, faced in the Dominican Republic with very serious discrimination. I mean, they don't, in fact, the Dominican Republic recently took away their. These are Haitian kids born there. They took away their citizenship, so they can't be considered Dominican. See, even though they're born in the Dominican Republic, they can't have citizenship. And it creates a kind of stateless group of Haitians that they were never born in Haiti, but they're not received in Dominican Republic where they work. And it's a very sad kind of situation.
They're displaced from the country. They have nothing.
They don't, you know, it takes away what little they have, you know. And I know the church has been doing a lot about that in Dominican Republic, trying to help them, because they're really at the bottom of the heap in terms of the social, care or concern or anything like that.
Father, it's such an incredible chain, because then you have the Dominicans that leave the Dominican Republic to go to Puerto Rico to be on U.S. soil.
That's true.
It's
true. It's not, you know, it's like one group coming into the other group leaving, you know, to go somewhere else.
And they go in these little boats by the hundreds, because once they come illegally into Puerto Rico, they are in U.S. territory.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Now, we went through a period where we were turning the boats back to Haiti. We were returning them to Port-au-Prince, and that was criticized a lot because these little boats, you know, they tore down all the trees to make the rafts to get out of the country. Now that the country is practically treeless, and it's in itself it created problems. But the U.S. didn't want to receive the Haitians the way they received the Cubans, which is sort of, if a Cuban raft hits Key West, then it's accepted and you're put into an asylum process and refugee status and all that. But Haitians, no, they're still turned back. They used to send them to Guantanamo, but they don't do that anymore. And they pick them up and just return them back to Haiti ports, you know. So it's declined a lot, the boat traffic, because people realize they're just going to be sent back, and it's not worth them the money and the expense of trying to pull together a boat and all that. So it's sort of blocking a problem that has to get solved one way or another over the years, you know.
And this is on this side of the world. Then on the other side of the world, you have the Syrian problem that is so enormous.
It's enormous.
And to tell you the truth, I think has no solution.
Well, it's overwhelming. I mean, it's really true that we now have more displacement in the world in general than after World War II. I mean, it's the numbers of people who are displaced and moving to other places is enormous. I mean, it takes your breath away when you actually start looking at the numbers, and you sort of say, oh my gosh, how are we ever going to deal with this? Especially if it keeps coming, you know, it doesn't stop. It's not like one flow. It's a continual after every violent act, people decide, we have to get out of here. We can't stay here anymore. And they just move. So half the population of Syria has already moved into other countries. And they're all trying, of course, to get to Europe because they can feel they can get jobs and live better and safer lives there than they can in the Middle East. So they're willing. They have a little money, which is makes them a little unusual for other migrants who, are dead poor, perhaps don't have the money to really move. But they can pay for some of the boats and things that other people may not be able to afford to try to get their families out of the country and into somewhere safe. And they do. They often get robbed, and there's some pretty awful stuff going on in the process, of moving.
But now the borders in Europe are closing their doors to all the Syrians refugees that are coming.
Yeah, the Eastern Europeans now are closing up, and they don't want any part of it, and it's a challenge. I don't know how Europe's going to deal with it, because they can't agree. The countries are fighting really hard against each other for various, solutions that are being proposed. In the United States, we're sort of lucky because we have, the states are kind of united under the federal government for a policy, so that if the feds decide, okay, we're going to receive so many refugees next year, the states go along with it, basically. It's kind of accepted. But in Europe, every country is for itself, and they don't necessarily agree on anything, and it gets crazy. Some of these meetings they've been having are just awful, and we're dealing with human lives. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, so many. I was in Malta last May, the island in the Mediterranean, and they've been one of the receiving, and they're just overwhelmed. I mean, it's a little island, they can barely, hold their own population, let alone all these migrants now living there and trying to get out of there into Europe.
And what do they do? Do they have, like, encampments for them?
Yeah, they have sort of makeshift encampments. Usually they try to use, warehouses or someplace so they can have cover rather than living on the, in the outdoors. And Maltese have been pretty generous. I mean, they've been really, the people do try to help. They bring them food, and there is kind of a sense, well, we can't let these little kids, not just sit there and not go to school or do anything. So they have little classes and things. They try to do their best, but they're overwhelmed. I mean, they don't know what to, where to turn in many cases. And it was sad to see in a lot of ways, because a lot of them are young people, to see that their lives so disrupted is really hard.
And this brings other consequences, disease. Because, they're all contained in one area.
Yeah, very serious problem.
Human trafficking, prostitution, all these
all
things.
All of it's
surface.
Mixed in there. Everything's mixed in. And so they have to, they're in danger almost every step they take on these boats and everything. It's pretty crazy, the whole thing, because the countries don't really protect them. They just kind of deal with whatever happens. If a boat comes in, well, they let the refugees go, but then they don't really enforce the law in any way that would stop the smugglers or the traffickers, particularly. The trafficking is very serious, especially for young girls.
Mm-hmm.
And to break that chain, these are highly sophisticated criminal organizations, and they know, and even in our southern border, the center, I'm very involved with the children coming up from Central America. We have about 90,000 unaccompanied children that entered the country without any parents.
90,000?
90,000 as of this year. I'm on the interagency task force in Washington that's trying to deal with the numbers. But one of the problems is the particularly the young girls. I mean, they're coming in through trafficking networks who exploit them and try to, they take them even out of Mexico and bring them somewhere else in the world. There's a lot of rapes and a lot of it's very terrible. And you really try to figure out what could we do that can best deal with all these kids and how to how to handle the flow, because it's even in our own country, it's not, you know, it's not Syria, or the numbers aren't as great as they're finding in the Middle East or Europe, but still we have a lot of people coming into this country, and it's how to deal with them is not an easy task, you know, especially when they're underage children, and you can't, I mean, I went out looking at a facility in Chicago where they're putting up some of the kids, and I mean, the kids were 6, 7, 8 years old, you know, and they could hardly put on their clothes in the morning. And I'm thinking, how can they argue for an asylum case? Or, you know, it's the kind of thing where you say, well, even if they have a good grounds for staying in the United States and being protected, who's going to articulate that for them? You know, these little ones, they don't know half the time where they are or what they're doing. And it's, you know, kind of, and there's a shortage of lawyers for them to represent them, you know, and so it's a big mess, I guess is what I would say right now. And, you know, the government's trying to sort the stuff out, but they're not used to these things, to, like kids, they're not used to large numbers of children, and dealing with them has been really problematic, you know, in terms of how they...
So is it that the parents send these children ahead to get them out of poverty?
Well, in many cases, they have a father or a mother or a brother or sister here, unauthorized in the country, working. And they send money back, often, let's say, to the grandmother, who hires the smuggler to bring the child up, because they've been hearing so much about the violence in the Central America and how children are being killed by gangs, and they want to get their kid out of there. And naturally, I mean, it's a natural emotion. And then so the grandmother ends up hiring a smuggler who brings them up. It usually costs maybe $5,000 for a normal case. If you have a girl and you really want to protect her in terms of the trafficking and, you know, better treatment, not getting raped or something, you might go up to about $8,000, $9,000 they assign a woman then to kind of be with her all the time and all that. But it's expensive, as you can imagine. I mean, it wipes out their savings in many cases, and they have to, you know, but they're so desperate to get the child up here. But then there's a problem when they get up here. They can't, you know, they're unauthorized immigrants, and you can't. The big question is, what are you going to do? Are you going to deport the kid and the family, that you unite the kid with the family and then you deport them all? I mean, what good is that? I mean, are you going to send them all back again? And then how do you deal with that problem? You know, because they're going back to where they may be murdered.
Can these children that are here go to school, even though they're in...
Under the Supreme Court ruling back in the 1980s, they said all undocumented children have a right to free public education K through 12. The trouble is, what we're finding is across the country, the school systems don't want them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, on Long Island and other places, they're saying we can't afford... Mm-hmm. This, you know, they have to be taught English, and we don't have the English teachers. We can't, da da da. They go on and on. And now, but the government, I mean, the state and all, is saying, well, you have to. It's under the Supreme Court law that you have to take them. Somehow you have to take them. And there's a big controversy right now. Some schools are taking, others are not. And it's kind of a mess, another part of the mess.
How does Catholic Charities come into this? Are they capable of helping in any way?
They are, and I've been encouraged them to take a really stronger role even with the children, because they need that kind of an agency, you know, to help kind of with the, not just with the child, but with the parents and everything. And the parents tend to trust Catholic Charities, mm-hmm. and now they have the church symbolize a lot of more safety for them and things that they can talk honestly, and they don't have to worry all the time. So I think going to some of our agencies in the Catholic Church, I think, is important for them and for the child, you know, that they learn to and to get advice on how to handle this stuff, because it can get very complicated, you know, when you're talking about the federal government and immigration law and what's, you know, how vulnerable are the children? Should the children be sent back? What's the, you know, how are you going to send them back, and what are they going to go to when they go back? I mean, I hear them talking in Washington, you know, send the child, we'll just put them on a plane, send them back to Guatemala City. Well, The kid lives in a rural area up in the mountains. How's he getting up there? And what's when he gets there, are the gangs in control of the whole territory? And what do you, you know, is there any way to protect them? I mean, that's again the church comes in, you know, as a possibility of sort of taking care of some of these kids if they have to be returned, or even the families if they get sent back, that they, you know, at least have some safe zones.
Are there any orphanages where they can
they
go?
They don't have, no, they don't have. In fact, one nun told me, you know, she runs a reception place for children in Honduras. She's the only one in the country. There's the only, and she's overbooked. I mean, they're in, like, on top of each other there. And the, you know, there's only one agency you can refer the child to if you're afraid he's going to get killed going back to his gang village or something. She'll take him, but it, you know, it's like she says, I can't take him anymore. There's no room here. There's nothing I can do, you know. And I think, oh, Lord, we have to do something better than that. I mean, you can't just dump the kids into things. So, you know, we even here in the United States are facing these kind of issues. And you can imagine what it's like in Europe and other places that are getting crowds and crowds and crowds of the migrants, you know, that are fleeing mainly for a group, especially the Syrians. The Syrians qualify under international law for being persecuted and actual refugees under international law, which means they have certain rights as refugees, you know. They shouldn't be sent home, and they have other things that the international law says about it. But the refugees, but what's happening, unfortunately, sadly, I can understand it, but Afghanis, Pakistanis are all saying they're Syrians, and they're coming in the same flows.
And you have the terror situation.
And ISIS, the Islamic State has said, we're going to infiltrate the European and American pipeline for refugees, and, you know, so everybody's, oh, okay, they're going to infiltrate. What will that mean? So we have to develop much better screening for the refugees to make sure that we're not bringing people that we shouldn't be bringing either into Europe or into the United States. I mean, both, I mean, Europeans understand that problem too, that you have to be very careful with these huge numbers and how you sort them out. You know, right now they're not getting registered. They arrive in Greece or Turkey or someplace, and they're supposed to be under international law registered as refugees in the first country they come to. But a lot of the countries like Greece are saying, oh, we can't do it. There's no way we're going to register all
so
this.
So they just shuffle them
up. They just keep them going, put them on a train, send them back to the next country, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but somewhere along the line, you have to stop and screen them and figure out who are they, why are they here, what's going on. And that's, I mean, Germany is doing it, but that's the only country right now that's really has a full system, you know, of screening that's happening.
Well, we certainly want to be able to discuss this further, and we will. But right now we can't because we've run out of time, and which is a pity. But that's Father Riscavige. We'll just let our listeners know he's been speaking with the Reverend Richard Riscavige, who is a Jesuit priest, director of the Center for Faith and Public Life at Fairfield University, a Jesuit school in Fairfield, Connecticut. We are delighted to have you with us, and we can't wait to get a little deeper into this very, very complicated, very involved situation. To our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join us again, and God bless you all.